Welcome to our discussion of active shooter incident management. Today we've got with us Stephen Shaw, Sergeant from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Adam Penley, Assistant Chief with Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, Mark Rame, retired fire chief from Deltona, Florida, and Orange County, Florida, and Joe Ferrara, also retired fire chief from Martin County, Florida. My name is Bill Godfrey, also retired fire chief, and your host this afternoon. And our question today is, what do you think is the biggest misconception that people have about active shooter incident management? Adam, why don't we start with you? What's on your mind about the big misconceptions that you see on the law enforcement side or the dispatch side?
Well, I think one of the misconceptions is this idea that it's entirely the first responder, the police officer, fire, EMS, and that is definitely an important role. But I think it's important to remember that all of the active shooter incidents start in the 911 center. And that initial recognition of an active shooter event is so important, and that initial intelligence gathering and getting the right resources dispatched is so important to the ultimate success of managing an active shooter event. Not only does it start there, but as the first responders arrive on scene and they're giving those initial report backs and follow-on responders are dispatched, in a lot of training that you see for active shooter incident management, you don't see dispatch integrated into the training and response. And I just think that's an important thing that must be addressed as we move forward to try to manage these active shooter events.
Steve, what do you think on the law enforcement side? Adam obviously addressed something near and dear to all of us on the comm side. What jumps out at you on the law enforcement side?
I think the biggest thing after Columbine, the focus was so much for law enforcement. The focus was so much on going after the threat, neutralizing the threat. I've actually been told in active shooter training that the incident management aspect of it will take care of itself. Someone will come along, a chief, a captain, someone like that, who will come along and take care of that. So your average first line supervisor especially does not put a lot of thought into, there needs to be a command and control aspect within the first 5 minutes of an active shooter event that's set up very quickly. I think that's one of the things that as on the law enforcement side, during training, we focus so much on going after the threat, neutralizing the threat, and then we just kind of stop our training there, and we don't get into reunification. We don't get into press briefings. We don't get into where are we going to send all of our injured people. And I think that's one thing that's missing from the law enforcement side. It's just we don't practice that incident management side of it enough.
It kind of stops with the bad guy down.
Correct.
Yeah. Joe, what's your perspective on the fire EMS side?
Well, I think, you know, from a fire and EMS perspective, we do command really well. We do incident management well, and, you know, we assist our law enforcement brethren with that. The part where I think fire and EMS has a hurdle and we need a paradigm shift is we're all trained that the scene is not safe, so we're going to stage and wait for law enforcement to clear the scene. Well, that doesn't work in active shooter incidents. People are going to bleed to death. We need to get in there. We need to work with our law enforcement partners. We need to form our rescue task forces, go in as a security bubble, and get the job done. We don't need to wait for a half hour, an hour. People don't have that kind of time. So the shift that's occurring in the industry is that we as fire and EMS professionals, we need to train on the rescue task force concept, work together with law enforcement to move in, get the patients together, get them on ambulances, and get them to the hospital.
Mark, what about you?
I agree with Joe. If you went back 30, 35 years ago in my career, we used to go into scenes that were today considered unsecured. We literally would just go in under the belief that we could handle anything, even without law enforcement presence. We would just respond into the scene. And then we flipped it 180 degrees where we started staging out. And it got to the point that we were staging out for so long that you were kind of wondering, is the scene actually still active or not? Because we would be out there for 20 or 30 minutes just sitting so far away, not knowing what's going on, with little or no communication. This program that we're in right now with active shooter incident management allows us to get together very, very quickly, develop those game plans, not put our fire and EMS people in harm's way per se, but to get them in there as quick as possible so we can save those lives. And it's a better process than what we've been doing for the last 10 or 15 years.
You know, that you brought that up is kind of interesting. This kind of parlays into some of the challenges with integrating the response. You know, each of the disciplines, law enforcement, fire, EMS, they do a good job in their own right, but in active shooter, it gets kind of challenging for us to execute our missions because we have to so closely rely on each other. What do you think are some of the things that you've seen, the trends on the integration side or the challenges that lie there? Tag that into your thoughts.
Well, the problem is that nationwide, as we travel around the nation, you're seeing we're not up to that point where we are integrating. There are some departments that are practicing this on a regular basis. We have some people here with their own department that do that whenever they do standbys. They'll actually put rescue task force together, and it creates a great environment for those events that are planned. What you're seeing out there is you still have that silo effect. You have firefighters, EMS departments, and law enforcement that believe they do an excellent job on their own, but when they put them on the same page or put them together, they don't play well with each other. And that's what we need to bridge. We need to get these people in there where they can at least start talking about how we can get together and form these teams and form a command structure that is us working together instead of apart.
Yeah, Adam, you know, he mentions the silos, and we've had some incidents where because the responders on the scene didn't get together in a command post, they ended up siloing their communications and actually using dispatch as a go-between. How big of a challenge do you think that still is in the country, and, you know, where are the gaps? What's the road we still have to cover?
Well, I think one of the things that Mark pointed out is that the responders work well together. They, you know, police and fire and EMS, if you put them in the same room, they work well together. What I think where we fail is that as that moves up the chain of command, you lose something in policies that allow that integration to really work, and you lose a command staff presence where it starts getting managed in different directions. The silos happen at a higher level, and it's like where most incidents fail is at the management level, not so much at the ground level. The first responders, they want to save lives, and if you don't have policies and you don't have conversations and you don't have a command element that works well together and all moving in the same direction, and I think that's where it fails. And on the communication side, again, I think if all levels train together, both from the first responder level through dispatch and then all the way up to the command level, I think you start to bridge some of those gaps.
So what Adam's talking about, Stephen, you know, kind of flows with some of the challenges we've seen with people kind of feeling like unified command is the magic bullet. And, you know, we're gonna operationally direct the troops from the unified command post. Do you still see that as a problem out in the field? You see that's an area that we need to work on?
I think it depends. You certainly see on big scenes, police, fire, EMS really want to work together in a unified command. On smaller scenes, people still tend to do the silo thing. You know, police are off doing their thing, fire's off doing their thing. Maybe fire and EMS coordinates a little bit, or police tell a firefighter, hey, well, I need you to come over here, help me out with this. But I think where we would start turning a corner real world is if we started working together on even smaller events. If police and fire are at the same place, then the police and fire commanders need to be hooked up. And that's something that I see in my area a lot. We still tend to do the silos a lot rather than working together. When we have these big events, like I said, large structure fires, large crowd management events, you see them working together. But on smaller events that we do day to day, I think we could definitely use a little bit more integration.
So, Joe, how do we fix it? How do you think we address some of those challenges and get people to see a better path forward or a quicker path forward?
Well, you know, as Stephen said, and, you know, I certainly agree, you know, in the fire service, when we started doing incident command, we did it on every incident, no matter how minor the incident was. We set up command, we named the command, we used the titles, but, you know, that didn't happen overnight. That took years and years of conditioning to do that. to do that sort of training. So I think together with law enforcement, like Stephen said, in his jurisdiction, they're doing that on these smaller incidents, and the law enforcement leadership is getting together with the fire and EMS leadership, and they're running a unified command, and really that's the only way. So as an industry, we just need to push that with our partners so that, you know, when fire goes back and they leave these classes and law enforcement goes back to their respective jurisdictions, then they sit down and they go, okay, and maybe you're not going to do it every time. You know, pick a Tuesday like we used to do in fire. We pick Triage Tuesday. Well, on Triage Tuesdays, everybody got a triage tag. So if we're going to do that with these, let's pick a day, let's pick a time when on an incident where law enforcement is there and fire is there, we're going to get together on incident command and we're going to run this incident.
And absolutely, and I just want to extend on what he said, is that it's, in addition to the command element, it's a unified effort. So as you get closer to the life saving in the area around the warm zone and tactical and triage and transport issues that happen so close to the life saving, that is a unified effort. And as you get into the command post, when you're talking about the misconceptions for active shooter, law enforcement is going to remain in command of the scene probably longer than people realize. And that's okay. As long as the fire EMS element is there standing shoulder to shoulder with the incident commander, that is most likely law enforcement, for a good period of time when the incident starts, but there's still a unified effort there. There's still a medical branch happening. There's still other things happening that move in the same direction. And what's interesting about that is we mentioned large fire scenes. We've done that for years. On a large fire scene, the fire commander is the incident commander for a lot longer into the incident than law enforcement would be. We're not really in a unified command mode when we roll up on a large structure fire, let's say. We're doing the law enforcement branch. It's still a unified effort. And it's just the roles are reversed a bit in an active shooter. And I think it's important to realize that the actual incident command may rest with law enforcement a little longer than we realize, and that eventually, once the unified effort is in place and the incident slows down a little bit, then we move more into a unified command element. And I think that's kind of important to recognize.
Thing too, talking about the command post being there for a long time, especially on the law enforcement side. As law enforcement officers, just as a nature of the culture of our job, we tend to really get down into the weeds, and we really want to. We have trouble letting go of any sort of responsibility. So if you're an incident commander, it's important for you to delegate some of that responsibility off to. If you're a captain and you show up, you're the IC. Delegate some of that stuff off to your sergeant or your lieutenant so that you're not doing everything by yourself. If you're too far down into the weeds, you're not doing your job right as an incident commander. It's your job to look big picture, eyes up. We talk about a 30,000 foot, 50,000 foot view, but you have to keep your eyes up and forward, looking at challenges that may come down the road, not just ones that we're dealing with right now, but anything that we can foresee, that we can easily foresee down the road, is something that's an incident commander's job, is to look at those events rather than focus so much on what's going on in the present.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that Stephen raises, Mark. When we teach in the active shooter incident management course, we divvy up the roles and responsibilities. There's, you know, the command post has some significant roles and responsibilities, but the actual running or the management of the downrange stuff is really done at that tactical triage and transport level. And I know you're frequently one of the incident command post coaches. Why do you think that matters so much, that splitting up of those roles and responsibilities? And, you know, why isn't it okay for command to just run everything from themselves directly?
I think what a lot of people don't realize, even in our industry, in public safety, they don't realize that there's a lot that's going to happen on that incident command level. They're at that 50,000 foot level and they're handling a lot of issues. Anything from dealing with their own bosses, with politicians, dealing with school administrations or public safety or public place management. They got to deal with those people and they got to make sure they got the right resources there to be successful in this event. When you get down to that tactical level and where you have a triage and a transport stood up, those people are worrying about that hot zone, that immediate threat area, and that's what they're dealing with. Unlike incident command, who's really looking at such a bigger picture, and they're dealing with those big events that they have to deal with on a regular basis.
Adam, what do you think? With what Mark's describing there, how does that become impactful for law enforcement? Because they obviously have, as Mark said, you know, you've got the hot zone, you got the warm zone, you've got that immediate scene downrange where you have to neutralize the threat. We've got to provide rescue to the injured and get them off the scene. But from a law enforcement mission, there's a whole lot more to it.
Absolutely. And a lot of your active shooter training is all that downrange stuff. We teach a lot about how to neutralize threats and to begin rescue and do those sorts of things, but we forget the fact that everyone is coming to this event. City leaders, other stakeholders, other agencies, federal agencies. So I think it's command's most important job is to be that next layer away from the scene to act as a buffer against all of that stuff that may interfere with the actual life-saving that is happening downrange. If you allow everyone that's responding to this terrible event in your community to make it all the way down to the edge of where the life-saving is happening, they're going to get in the way. There's going to be, you're gonna interfere with the actual life-saving. So let those first responders who know what they're doing have a unified effort of life-saving at the tactical triage and transport level, and then the command post should be that extra layer of management that's going to be looking outward to everything else that's going to be pouring in on you because you've had this terrible tragedy in your community. And like Steven said, it doesn't just stop at when the patients are transported. You're looking at days, if not weeks, worth of management that's going to continue. And you start that early at the command post level looking outward. If everyone's focused on trying to do the life-saving job, then you have an entire incident management team focusing on one objective. And you have many, many more objectives that are falling in on you.
Well, that really sums it up pretty well. I think paints the picture pretty nice. Guys, thanks for taking the time to sit down this afternoon and kind of talk about this. As we've been discussing, we're going to grapple with this and a lot more questions as time goes on. Adam, Mark, Joe, Steve, thanks for taking the time, and hope you all enjoyed it.